We're very happy to have our next guest, David Trower, joining us. David is Ojibwe. He's from the Leech Lake Reservation here in northern Minnesota. He now divides his time between Leech Lake and Los Angeles, where he is a professor of literature at USC. He's written several award-winning and critically acclaimed novels, as well as a nonfiction book entitled Res Life. His latest book, just out, is called Prudence. David, I want to thank you for joining us and welcome you to the Roadhouse.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Buck. I'm glad to be back. It's sort of a virtual return to Minnesota, but a return nonetheless.
And are we speaking to you from Los Angeles or from Leech Lake?
I hesitate to tell you where I am, but I am in Santa Monica looking out over the ocean, and it's a beautiful day here.
Oh, man.
California. Sorry to tell you that.
That's great for you.
Yeah.
Actually, any of those three places would be a great place to be speaking to you from. Your latest book, Prudence, can you give our listeners just a very brief overview of this book?
Sure. It's something of a love story, although, you know, like all real love, perhaps maybe thwarted into times. But it's a World War II love story. It takes place on a resort in northern Minnesota and also across Europe. And, that's about all I want to give away. But
okay.
that's the heart of it.
You know, it's set in the 30s and 40s at a small resort. It's located within a reservation in the North Country, much like Leech Lake Reservation,
yeah,
where you're from.
Indeed.
And I'd have to say that the description the book starts off with of that little resort, a small family resort, is right on. I mean, it just put me exactly, I think most of us who have spent time in the Northland and are of a certain age can remember exactly what those little resorts were like.
They're really unique to America and unique to our part of it, I think. You know, in England, you have all these famous novels, right? You know, these Austen novels and Dickens novels and Evelyn Waugh novels, and they have a kind of what they call the manor novel. These stories that take place at these English manor houses, where you know like Gosford Park or Downton Abbey, where you have classes mixing and different people, different agendas, all thrust together in the same place. We don't have places like that in America, but we do have resorts, which have a kind of similar function, and for me, you know, the northern Minnesota resort was a chance to explore the ways in which natives and non-natives come together, work together, love, hate, and do all those human things together, as opposed to the usual way we have of thinking of Indian white relationships as only oppositional, as only never the twain shall meet, as only dramatically violent.
You know, I remember those little resorts as being very warm, very welcoming, very friendly. The owners of the resort is Emma Washburn. I believe her husband's name was Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just seem just the opposite of that. Emma's, you know, she just doesn't get it. She doesn't get relationships. She doesn't get other people. And Jonathan is just totally disinterested, and he seems racist, and he's a philanderer, and, you know, his wife doesn't really affect him in any positive way.
Yeah, there are all sorts of couples in this book, right? There's Jonathan and Emma, and then there's, later on, there's Prudence, and, well, she would hope Frankie. There's Billy, and then later on, much later on in the novel, his wife Stella. There are all sorts of couples, but there's only really one effective couple, only one romantic pairing which anyone could consider healthy or loving. And that's ironically the relationship which in that time and place would have been forbidden. And that's the relationship between Frankie and Billy.
And Billy, of course, being... maybe we should touch on my favorite character in the whole book, which was Felix. And he was a kind of a stoic Indian who Emma reluctantly hired and turned out to be much more than a stereotype, but a true character.
Yeah, Felix, I'm really fond of him. You know, he he hews really close to the stereotype of the stoic, sort of closed mouth, unemotional, physically powerful Indian man. But he is, as you say, much more than that. And that was part of the fun of the book, right? Let's take characters who we think we know, types of people we think we know, and show that, you know, one, we don't really know them in the ways that we think we do, and and to remember that people always surprise us. And Felix is very much a character, I hope, that surprises us. He's quite amazing. He's far more than anyone thinks he is. But, you know, that's sort of part of the human condition I explore in the book, are the ways in which, as human beings, as members of a community, we get each other wrong so often. We take the wrong message. We get the wrong measure of people. We misunderstand them. We get everything wrong as human beings, and maybe that's the most human thing after all.
And Emma is the best one at doing that in the whole book.
Yeah, she has all these ideas about Felix, you know, since you like him so much. Oh, he's illiterate and this and that, and he's not illiterate. He's actually well-traveled, and he's a World War I veteran. He's been overseas. He's seen his share of the world. He can read very well, if slowly, but and she constantly sells him short.
And you started to speak of the relationship between Billy, who is a friend of Felix, who comes in to help him at the resort, and Frankie, who is the son of Emma and Jonathan Washburn, as being the only love interest in the book that really is functional.
Yeah, Billy comes on the resort in the 30s when he has a dock boy, some extra help, and he quickly becomes friends with Frankie, the son of the resort owner, this really privileged kid. And it's, for the two boys, it's sort of love at first sight. And they don't even really have any kind of language for how they feel. They don't think of themselves as straight or gay or anything. They don't even have a vocabulary to describe how they feel for each other. They just know that they love each other. It's instant for them. Mm-hmm. They mess up here and there. They make mistakes, as all people do, and those have drastic consequences, and that's sort of what kicks the novel off. But that's one of the ironies the book explores, are the ways in which really the only viable relationship is the relationship between these two boys, but it's the one relationship that society won't condone at that time, at that place.
And the kind of the event that really everything in the book follows, and it follows all the characters throughout the rest of the book, was an event that happened due to this group of folks following a POW, thinking that they're going to capture this German POW who had escaped from a nearby POW camp, and resulted the death of one Ojibwe woman and the wounding of another.
Yeah. There actually was a POW camp, a German prisoner of war camp on Leech Lake Reservation, just outside the village where my family's from, the village of Bina, just down the road from Duluth there. And it always struck me as ironic that reservations are so often imagined as places outside of time that aren't really linked to or affected by, or in turn, that affect current events. And yet, you know, the most current event of those times, of course, was the war, and it came right home to Leech Lake. And so I wanted to see how that played out. And so the novel kicks off when Frankie returns for one last visit to the resort before he joins the Air Corps. And before they can properly celebrate his return and his impending departure, they all gather together to go out and search for a German POW who's escaped. Everyone's very excited, and they want to get the kraut, as they put it. And while they're in the woods, Frankie makes a horrible error of judgment, and things go terribly wrong. And the echoes of that mistake are heard throughout the years.
There's a I believe there's a, as I learned more about your life, David, I believe there's several elements of this story that came from your personal experience, your personal history. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, in the sense that, you know, I'm Ojibwe from Leech Lake, and so, you know, that whole aspect of the story is sort of drawn from the place that I care about the most and love the most. But my father's also, he's Jewish. He's not from Leech Lake. He's from Austria, and he was a Holocaust refugee, and he fled to the States. So World War II was very present in my life in terms of what happened to my father. And then subsequently, my mother's father was a World War II veteran, and the war was felt by her side of the family and his war experiences that he brought home with him, and that we all sort of, over the years, had to contend with ourselves. Wars don't just happen over there. They come home in ways that are sometimes very difficult, very painful. So all of that came together in the novel for me, for sure.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you came up with the title and the name of Prudence? I know there's a story behind it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so, yeah, there not only is the German prisoner of war camp a true bit that I wanted to explore in an imagined context, but Prudence herself, there's a kernel of truth. There's a real Prudence that lurks behind my fictional one. Ernest Hemingway claims that the first woman he ever pleasured, those are his words, was an Ojibwe girl named Prudence Bolton in northern Michigan when he vacationed there as a young man near Traverse. And the biographer did some work and realized that she did exist, this Prudence Bolton, that she was an Ojibwe girl who lived in that area at that time and that her past definitely crossed with Hemingway's past. All that's really known about her is that she committed suicide with her lover, Richard Castle, when they were both 19. They drank strychnine together and committed suicide together, and she was pregnant. That's all that's really known about her. And I felt that it's profoundly unfair that we know all the stuff about Hemingway and people like Hemingway, but we don't really know much about her or people like her. That hers is a life that often goes unimagined. And I wanted to do her justice. I wanted to imagine, well, what was her life like? What did she care about? What were her concerns? Why would she do something like that? The historical record doesn't tell us, and so where the historical record leaves off is where novels really begin.
It's funny how things kind of like that stick with you. You know, I imagine that you had read that sometime before, and yet
I read that. Oh, yeah. Sorry to interrupt, but yeah, I read that little detail when I was probably 22, and it stuck with me for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I constantly return to it in my mind, you know, they say write what you know, and there's some of that, to some extent, that's true, but for me, the real pleasure and the real mission of fiction, of novels, is to try and imagine the lives of others. Especially those whose lives and whose values and whose concerns are very different than ours. I couldn't imagine what Prudence's life was actually like, the real Prudence Bolton. What did she see? What could life give her? What could she make of her life? What did she think? And I can't know. And so I felt it almost a duty to try and imagine what her life was like.
We're speaking with David Troyer, and we're talking about David's new book. It's just out, called Prudence. There was another story that came from your past. It came out again in this book, and it had to do a lot with stray dogs. Maybe you could talk a little about that.
Yeah. So Prudence was drawn a little bit from life, and then the German prisoner of war camp was drawn a little bit from life. There was also an event, not in my life, but a story I heard from my father, something that happened on the Red Lake Reservation in the village of Panema back in the 60s, where in these small villages, there are a lot of dogs, and these are poor places, and people didn't have access to veterinarians, or even they didn't have the money to go to a vet, should it even occur to them. People were poor, and so when people had dogs, their dogs met up with the neighbor dogs, and everyone had more dogs. There's just dogs everywhere. So in these small villages, what they would do is once a year, thereabouts, usually in the spring, they would gather, and the men would gather, and they'd go out, and they'd shoot dogs for a day or a weekend to sort of call the herd, as it were, call the pack. And one time in the 60s, the men gathered in Panema. They went to go shoot dogs, and these two men were out, and they saw a dog in the brush, and they shot it. And when they were waiting for it to die, because the rule of thumb is you never approach a dying animal, even something like a deer. You wait till it's down and it's done. You could get hurt. So they wait till the dog's done thrashing around in the brush, and then they went to go get it and throw it in the truck. And when they walked up to it, they realized that it wasn't the dog at all, that they'd shot a girl, a teenager or a middle school girl who'd been skipping school with a friend of hers, and they shot and killed her. This was horrible. This is a tiny village where everyone knows everyone. It's definitely what you'd call close-knit. And this was just a horrible thing to have happen in such a small, close-knit community. And I heard the story from my father some years ago, and he was on the scene, I think. And I remember thinking at the time, and this also stayed with me, I remembered wondering what that must have felt like for the person who made that mistake, for that man. How do you carry that weight for the rest of your life? How do you live with the results of an action which was split second and ill-considered, but not done in anger or any kind of rage or because you're a bad person? It's just a mistake. It's just a mistake. That's all it is. What do you do? What do you do next? And I wanted to imagine what that was like. So that also is sort of wrapped up in this horrible day in the woods that kicked off the novel.
I want to talk to you just a little bit about technique and about how you wrote this. And what sure. what seemed to me as I was reading this book is that things weren't written exactly like matter-of-factly, but there was no preaching in this book, whether it was from you or the characters concerning other characters. It was sort of like these shadows out there over what happened that people really needed to pay attention to what was not said. Was that how did you manage? Was that a conscious effort that you made through the book?
Kind of. I mean, there's a quote, a Marx quote that always comes to mind. In the 18th Brumaire, Louis Bonaparte, Karl Marx, says that all men make history, but they don't always make it with tools of their choosing. That basically, you make your life out of the materials at hand. That's all you've got. And that's always, for me as a novelist, really important to remember, that the people that I've put in motion in this book, they don't have everything at their disposal. They only have what they've got. They don't necessarily express themselves well. They don't necessarily have a big picture of life. They don't necessarily have answers, all the answers, much less most of the answers for what should be done, what should they do, where should they go, what they need to say, what they need to hold back. They're doing just the best they can. The best they can isn't always so great. And in that, these characters are just like us. We don't always have the words to express what we feel. When we try to say how we feel, we sometimes end up saying something else. We betray ourselves. We garble our thoughts. We misapprehend our own hearts. This is also what it means to be human. And so there wasn't some sort of conscious aesthetic mission in relation to what I have my characters express and what I have them withhold. I was trying to make them fully realized human beings, and as such, that's exactly what we do. I did have a mission with the book, though, which is to write a really plot and character-driven story in a language that was only as fancy as was necessary to tell the story. One of my own bad habits on display in many of my previous books, maybe, is that I can get overly fancy. I've got the pretty words. to say the pretty things. And I think it's a virtue that turned into a vice. And so I wanted to limit my addiction to that. I wanted to stop hiding behind my prose and see if I could just tell the story as simply as possible, and still have it be compelling, and create characters who carry the load. So that was an aesthetic choice. That was an artistic attempt. I felt really good about it. It's hard to write something plot-driven. It's much easier to just get all pretty when you write yourself into a corner. And it's much harder to restrain yourself, I think.
Your father was a Holocaust survivor. Mm-hmm. You mentioned him earlier, talking about the World War II aspect of this story. Your mother is a tribal court judge, Ojibwe.
Mm-hmm.
Both on both sides of your family, there's a history of oppression as far as where the people are from. Is that, of course, it's going to be part of you and part of your psyche, but was that a part of this book as well?
Oppression. I didn't think of it in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, both my parents suffered a lot, each in their own way. But more than that, they sort of transcended that suffering, and they made beautiful lives out of very little. They both started with very little, and they made really incredible lives. And I'm, you know, every day sort of grateful for them, and I'm impressed by the human beings they managed to be in the face of just incredible hardships that I don't think I'll ever be able to fully appreciate. So that said, you know, this isn't really a book about oppression. It's maybe, like my parents, it's a book about sort of people's ability to create lives of beauty in difficult and really trying circumstances. I think that many of the characters, despite their many faults and flaws and mistakes, manage to do that in their own way.
We've been speaking with David Troyer, and David is from the Leech Lake Reservation. He also lives in Los Angeles. He's a professor at USC. His latest novel is called Prudence, and we've been speaking to him about that book. David, have you got a website that people could go to learn more about yourself?
Sure. I have to warn any listeners that my website is sort of the last thing on my mind, so
okay.
It's not updated very often, but you can find some other writing, you can find some essays, you can find some reviews. It's just davidtroyer.com that's the website address.
And that's T-R-E-U-E-R.
That's correct, Troyer. David Troyer, T-R-E-U-E-R.
And your book, Prudence, can be found anywhere where you can buy books, so
sure.
People can find them readily. As well as your previous books. David, I want to thank you so much for joining us here tonight and giving us your time. It was our pleasure.
Oh, it's mine. It's not quite as good as being back in Minnesota, but I'll take it.